This is Beth McNamara, your host. I just want to give you a heads up that this episode contains discussion of child abuse, racial slurs, and animal cruelty, and is intended only for mature audiences. This is Jeanette Knighton, a.k.a. Pam Africa, a.k.a. Chairwoman of the International Concerned Friends and Family of Mumia Abu-Jamal and MOVE's Minister of Confrontation. She's in Philadelphia emceeing an event to celebrate the birthday of Ramona Johnson Africa. After updating the crowd about Mumia's legal case, Pam Africa is ready for the first speaker.
And this sister here has been through hell to stand up here with the teachings of John Africa. She don't bow, she don't bend. They beat real more than they beat anybody in the organization because she is a white member. I'll take that back. She's a MOVE member that happened to be white. One of the baddest sisters that ever walked the face of the earth that these motherfuckers feel to be walking. We are Africa.
MOVE members and very close MOVE followers know her as Rhea, but the rest of the world and the press, up until now, have known her as Sue.
My name is Sue Africa. I'm First Minister of Confrontation for the MOVE organization, and I've been in MOVE since 1972. I come from a very prestigious, rich background, born in Huntington Valley, and my father actually worked for the government. And he invented the ejection catapult seat. And he was very, very well off money-wise. But I had very bad health, extremely bad health. And I was always discontent.
Suzanne Levino, a.k.a. Sue Africa, a.k.a. Rhea, is Caucasian, white, and post-1985 plays a big role behind the gates of MOVE, more so than in front of the camera or on stage. And in previous episodes of this podcast, sources that are Black have talked about how race was discussed in general terms in MOVE and specifically when it came to leader Alberta Wicker and Rhea.
So color was a confusing concept for me in general.
This is Rain. She was born into MOVE in the year 2000.
But as I got older and started understanding race and the concept of race in my own cult way, like I knew Rhea was white. She was a white girl from suburbs. And what it was explained over and over again that Alberta was white and Sue was Black. Rhea was Black. And the N-word was said with the hard R and with the A out of Sue's mouth. She would talk about other white people as though she was being marginalized by them and she was a person of color being attacked. Or she should feel offended about things, really taking on like the white woman tears, very much so. And she moved and we were told that, yes, she's white, but she's not actually white. It was really weird, but that's what we were told.
For 50 years now, Sue, aka Rhea, has told her origin story of being an unhappy, unhealthy, rich white girl who realized that all of her problems came from the system. And so in joining MOVE, all her problems were solved. She became a revolutionary for John Africa on his mission to protect all life, which meant overthrowing the system and returning humankind to a pre-civilized state in harmony with Mother Nature. At this point in the podcast, you know that MOVE is very good at crafting a narrative. And by now, you know that I will dig and dig until I find a primary source to interview. I wanted someone who knew Sue before MOVE. And while it took months, I found someone.
What got my attention was when my mother showed me an article about Sue, and it was about MOVE.
This is Barbara. She grew up with Sue in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania.
A picture of them, it almost looked like they were in a manger or some sort of thing, the straw, describing their living conditions and the fact that they were making soap or something. I don't quite remember that, but I know it said something about they got money. So that certainly got my attention, because me being a hippie, I understood some of it. I didn't know at that time they were so radical. I just assumed they were a group that kind of wanted to do their own thing.
Barbara last saw Suzanne Lovino at their Lower Moreland High School graduation in 1967. But being that their town is very small, she has a lot of memories about Sue growing up, and she has personal photos to back them up.
We've probably known each other since we were 3 years old. Started out together in Sunday school and were in kindergarten together all the way through high school. We were like a very vanilla group of kids.
Suzanne Jean Lovino was born in 1949, just 2 years after her sister. The Lovino family belonged to the private Huntington Valley Country Club, and Sue was in the junior swim club. In a group photo from 1959, 10-year-old Sue is sporting a short bob haircut with bangs and a chevron-striped one-piece bathing suit.
Sue loved to be on stage as a child, dancing and everything else. She was in my ballet class. I believe she did the modern dance when I was taking ballet, did recitals. She was a 1950s conforming, you know, dressed a preppy look, just like everybody else. Sue was a very, very active student. I just had tremendous amount of energy.
She played basketball and field hockey. She was a cheerleader. She was in the chorus. She was in the a cappella group. She performed in school plays. She was on the yearbook staff. And she was on the pep club.
She was bubbly. She was the one that was involved in the, you know, the car washes, setting up car washes to raise money for the class.
So here it is, folks. The rich suburban cheerleader from Huntington Valley, she's the one who came up with the idea for MOVE to have its Powelton Village car wash.
My mother and her mother were good friends. Her mother was hospitalized for mental health. It was serious.
Sue's mother, Helene, was schizophrenic.
The community was very compassionate with the mother. But being the child of someone who's going through that, I can't really relate to what she was going through. I mean, mom in and out of the picture must have been difficult.
While Susie was growing up, her mother was in and out of mental institutions.
Our school was like very high achievers. We had several national merit scholarship winners, and it was very competitive. Even though she was smart, she was nowhere near the top of the class.
Sue graduated from Lower Moreland High School in 1967.
I went to college, but I had dropped out after like 3 years because I kept searching in religion, searching in Buddhism, just searching in academia and books. And I could never find what I wanted, what would make me happy, what would give me solution.
Barbara lost touch with Susie after graduation, but because their parents were friends, she would get updates.
My mom did tell me in 1970 that Sue had a child and that her mother was upset.
Did you ever see that child?
No.
And according to my sources from Inside MOVE, Sue herself said that she had given up a child for adoption. And in Sue's version of the story, she was 21 years old and her parents made her give up the baby girl because the baby girl was mixed race. Wanting to check this out further, I asked somebody born into MOVE, raised up under Rhea. This is Rain again.
Sue supposedly had a biracial child named Danielle, and that child was then adopted, and I believe it was a closed adoption.
Sue then moves into Philadelphia to take community college classes and to work.
I heard about MOVE through a friend of mine. We both worked in a restaurant up on Citywide Avenue, and I went to some of their study sessions where the guidelines of John Africa were read.
Vincent recognizes immediately that Sue is a useful tool. She comes from money, and he knows that she can bear children. And according to what Rhea told Rain, Vincent knew about her first child.
Vincent told her to go back and go get Danielle and to bring her back.
Closed adoptions in the 1970s made it almost impossible to find the children you gave up for adoption. So Sue is not able to bring Danielle into MOVE.
The guidelines of John Africa were read, and I had never heard anything like these guidelines, which completely broke down every facet of the system that we've been taught to believe in. And I remember hearing a section on child rearing where John Africa was talking about how babies are desensitized at birth and how the priority is always what's dead instead of what's alive. And this is what causes children to grow up with so many problems and turn into either child beaters, wife beaters, husband, you know, beaters, maniacs on all kind of drugs. And he was talking about how a child will be crawling on a carpet, and if the child spills milk on a carpet or scratches an end table, the mother or father will holler at the child and hurt the child's feelings, who is alive and has feelings, over something that is dead, which is the rug, the chair, the wood, and hurt your feelings over something that's dead. And I said, wow, that's exactly what happened to me in my house. I was always getting hollered at and told, don't touch this, don't break that. And so I felt a little niche right there, and I wanted to explore and find out more. And he gave this example, which fit right into my background, and that's what kind of brought me into MOVE.
Late July, early August, 1975, Sue gives birth to a son inside MOVE headquarters.
I was the first woman to deliver my child without the aid of any doctors, nurses, and I didn't think I could do something like that. I mean, I wasn't even in labor that I could recognize. That day I went out to run. The coordinator taught me to run, and I ran every day barefoot at a little enclosed park down at Drexel, and I ran 5 miles every day. The day I delivered, I ran 5 miles. I went home, I felt some pressure, I had my baby. I came out, like an hour later, there were news media there, and I did 50 sit-ups right after delivering a baby.
I have a photo of Sue the day she gave birth. She's posing on straw inside MOVE headquarters. She's wearing jeans and an Indian batik print t-shirt. Her hair is long, she has bangs. She's smiling. Laying in front of her on the straw is a naked newborn with evidence of a partial umbilical cord that Sue chewed through with her teeth. She licked her baby clean, just like animals do, because that is what Vincent Leiphart ordered. Neither the baby boy or Sue see a doctor, and he doesn't get a birth certificate. The first time anyone outside of MOVE will hear what the baby's name is in March 1978, when Sue does another interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer. And she says the baby's name is John, after John Africa. Both of Sue's parents have now passed away. When I called to speak with Sue's only sister, the husband said they had no idea if Sue was even still alive. They haven't had contact with her for decades. And he also told me this: they have always believed that the father of Sue's son, born in MOVE, was Vincent Leiphart. In MOVE, Sue was always given the above-ground activities to get into confrontations as a way to promote John Africa and get him some press. I've mentioned before that Sue was a key member in the first confrontation in Powelton Village, May 20th, 1977. Guns on the porch. Sue's 2-year-old son was not with her. She had left him in Richmond, Virginia, with other MOVE women and children. Guns on the porch results in terroristic and weapons charges for everyone involved. So when Sue tries to sneak out in an old lady disguise and gets caught by cops, she ends up in court. In typical MOVE strategy, Sue is confrontational with the judge, cursing him out, spouting MOVE law. And the judge is concerned about her mental competency to stand trial and represent herself. Again, MOVE strategy. Seriously concerned for Sue's mental health, the judge sends her to the state mental hospital for a psychiatric evaluation. Byberry State Hospital is only allowing Sue to see and talk to her parents. She's not allowed to have contact with MOVE at all. No phone calls, no visits. Vincent Leapart figures out how to bypass this by sending in someone that nobody realizes is a MOVE member, Mumia Abu-Jamal. At the time, he's a Philadelphia radio reporter and former Black Panther. Mumia gets in as a reporter, but this is really his MOVE activity. He is delivering communications from Vincent Leapart to Sue. This is late summer, early fall 1977. So this means Mumia Abu-Jamal is a MOVE member even earlier than we had previously thought. Mumia was there to deliver information, get intel on Sue to make sure she was still loyal to John Africa, and then he produced a radio piece that was pro-MOVE, saying that Sue was getting persecuted in this mental hospital because the government hates MOVE. Sue wrote an 11-page letter to the court while undergoing her psychiatric evaluation. This is some of what she wrote. Dr. Schwartzman stated on the witness stand, based on a 20-minute evaluation, that in his opinion, I was a paranoid schizophrenic. This unqualified diagnosis of Dr. Schwartzman was based on the four questions of the competency test and two others. They were, one, did I ever hear voices? I replied, if the voices aren't there, I don't hear them. As John Africa has taught all MOVE members the danger in hallucinating, fantasizing, speculating about life. Question two, did I really want to go to trial? This question impressed me at the time as being significant, and I replied, yes, I'm innocent, and I've been in jail for 4 months, separated from my family, and yet this system will tell you, quote, you are innocent until proven guilty. While on the witness stand, Dr. Schwartzman went on to say that he felt I, quote, could prepare a rational defense for myself, but did not profess to want to do so. Simply being in this hospital is a violation of MOVE's religion. I will consistently speak the principle of John Africa, no matter what activity I am sent on, but I refuse to have my sanity questioned, examined, studied by some experimenting doctor. An unjust person will ignore what is right and hold on to his goddamning pride. John Africa. She signs it Disciple Sue Africa, and then does the whole in natural law we trust, all praises the order of life, the power of truth is final, long live MOVE, long live revolution, long live John Africa, long live John Africa, long live John Africa. Not one time in this 11-page letter does Sue even mention her 2.5-year-old son. In the early part of 1978, Sue is released from the state hospital and posts bail while she awaits trial. She rejoins Vincent Leapart, who is on the run, because he is wanted by the ATF for a bomb plot. Now Sue is a fugitive, just like Vincent and Alberta and five others. They are hiding in Rochester, New York. While fugitives in Rochester, the MOVE members take on new names. Sue becomes Maria, which is then shortened to Rhea by her son John, that is now Tommaso. May 13th, 1981. Vincent Leapart, Rhea, Alberta, and four others are arrested in Rochester, New York by ATF, and all extradited back to Philadelphia to stand trial. Vincent was arrested on federal bomb-making charges. The feds found bomb-making materials and bombs, but they couldn't pin it on Vincent because he made sure that they couldn't. Two MOVE disciples went to prison on these charges, but Vincent skates. He's found not guilty by the jury and walks free. Not because he's omnipotent or superhuman, but because he's the leader, the criminal mastermind, who got his brainwashed followers to do his dirty work under coercion, threat, and deception. Rhea gets sentenced to prison, 12 years. She doesn't make arrangements for her parents to come pick up her son, Tommaso. She gives him to MOVE. He's the property of Vincent Leapart. Tommaso dies on May 13, 1985. He was just 2 months shy of his 10th birthday. Rhea serves her prison sentence at Muncie Prison with six other MOVE members, Consuela Dotson, Janet Holloway, Janine Phillips, Debbie Sims, Merle Austin, and Alberta Wicker. They're cellmates. Yep, the prison put them together. And they're all still in the cult, which means they are full-time coordinating, strategizing, and recruiting from behind bars. While all the MOVE members are in prison, there are still MOVE members on the outside, recruiting. This is how 17-year-old John Gilbride is brought into MOVE in 1985. It was through letters and prison visits that Rhea slowly pulled John in, using the common denominator that they were both white and they just didn't realize that they were dissatisfied with the system. Once Rhea had hooked John, she delivered him right to Alberta. 40-year-old Alberta gets released from prison on May 13, 1988, becoming the new leader of MOVE, marrying John Gilbride, 20 years her junior, in 1992. They have a son. John escapes MOVE, files for divorce and child visitation. He gets stalked, threatened, and surveilled by MOVE on Alberta's orders and is shot dead on September 26, 2002. Case still unsolved. Rhea has 4 more years to serve in prison after Alberta's released, so she keeps watch and control for Alberta over the 6 MOVE women still in Muncie Prison: Janet, Janine, Debbie, Consuela, Merle, and Ramona. In 1992, Rhea is released with no parole and no restrictions, so she moves into the new MOVE headquarters on King Sessing Avenue. Alberta and Rhea are back together and can now put their master plan into action: grow the cult and get more power and money. And Rhea is right underneath Alberta and must completely obey and serve Alberta. Rhea is 43 when she leaves prison. When Rhea first gets out, longtime white MOVE follower Gary Wunderlin is chosen to be her mate, until MOVE member Carlos Perez is released from prison and she switches to him. Rhea doesn't have children with either of them because her activity, her focus, is the Africa children, those born into the cult, Black children, one of them being Rain Robbins.
And she was definitely the enforcer of anything that Bert had to say. She was constantly on the phone with Bert or other people or prisoners and giving out MOVE law, and then she would dish it down on us. What she said went, and she ruled King Sessing because Bert didn't live there. So she was really the end-all be-all for me and what I saw growing up. And of course, like, you would always want to be in Rhea's house, like, sitting next to, like, her fireplace and, like, up under them, because that was closer to the center of the cult.
Rhea lived in one half of the 3-story Victorian twin house known as MOVE Headquarters in the West Philadelphia neighborhood next to Clark Park. From the way MOVE is always talked about as back to nature, you might have a vision of what their homes would look like. Or you might have seen the Powelton Village days of the MOVE headquarters. No furniture, no electricity, no plumbing. That's not how Rhea was living in MOVE headquarters as the second in command.
And there was like chairs that were set up like a parlor, like you're entertaining people Victorian style. There's 2 big chairs perched next to the fireplace. And then there was a long, Sue and Alberta would sit in the 2 chairs next to the fireplace with the little tables next to them and drink tea. And us kids would sit around their feet and near the fire. And then like Teresa or Pam and Mona and all of the like less significant adults, or like Carlos or someone, would sit on the couch, like the kind of tattered couch in the corner behind them. And then when you walk down the hall, it would go to her bathroom where the bathroom was. And it was like floral patterns and like delicate jewelry and her brooches and like perfume bottles, like in glass on her vanity. And then there was the kitchen and it was like full of plants and it was open and it was like little china teacups. Very much gave like she was hosting people in a parlor, a dilapidated parlor, but a parlor.
MOVE leader Alberta's house in suburban New Jersey was the nicer version of Rhea's parlor. As the enforcer, Rhea controlled every minute of every day of every member of MOVE, as ordered by Alberta. And she was always reporting back. It's like a giant 4-dimensional chessboard of psychological and physical control, which ping-pongs between love bombing, tirades, physical abuse, shunning, the silent treatment, and terror. The children in MOVE, with the exception of Zach, were deliberately in vulnerable positions. They didn't live in homes with parlors or teacups. They lived where they were told to live by Rhea and Bert, and they were poor. The children shared beds, slept on couches or the floor, and their diets were according to MOVE beliefs, just like in the early days, raw, onions, sweet potatoes, spinach, garlic, some fruits. It was the same forced malnutrition I told you about in the Kwashi Orkor episode in season 2. This was going on after Rain is born in the year 2000. MOVE adults don't follow the raw diet. Alberta and Rhea particularly feasted on fancy cooked foods, alcohol, and sweets.
So she would like have like little like candies, like the little hard candies in a bowl, or she'd have tea parties, or you get to sit and eat tea with her, and then, or she'd make you like an egg sandwich, very dainty food. When you were up under Rhea, it was these like dainty, very whitewashed, decadent Victorian type foods.
So this puts the children in a position to really covet an invitation to come to Rhea's parlor.
It was a treat to us because that wasn't normal to us whatsoever. So as a child, it was important, and how important it was to other people to be like up under her, because that was a source of MOVE law. That was where you were supposed to be happy at.
If you were up under Rhea as a kid, does that mean you're getting preferential treatment?
Yes. And I know there were specific children who were there more often, or at least she was controlling where they stayed, and they weren't with their parents as much.
Preventing or breaking the parent-child bond is a key component of MOVE belief, which is cult control. Rhea is considered the powerful MOVE law expert on nutrition, exercise, mental health, marriage, child rearing, and sex. All members must come to seek counsel from Rhea.
She would comment about us as young girls, like our body and the way we were shaped, and if we were good for having children. She was also partially in charge for fertility issues, like periods, and how to get pregnant, and what to eat, and what to do sexually. She grasped at not only child rearing, but the creation of children. That was her domain.
It is MOVE law that once a girl gets her period, she should get pregnant, and her mate is chosen by the leaders. First, that was Vincent. Then it became Alberta. And all of the adult MOVE members are directed to participate in this coercion of children. The grooming and normalization of this belief and sexualization for the sake of procreation starts when the child is born. It is the norm, not the exception. And everyone in MOVE has had to go along with it for 50 years. Both Vincent and Alberta needed to plan out how to make more MOVE people, more MOVE babies, which are the easiest followers to control, because they will only know life according to the doctrine. Before Vincent was in control of humans, he was in control of animals. Remember, pre-MOVE, he was known in Powelton Village as Vinny the Dogman, the guy who would pick up stray dogs and feed them raw horse meat. When Vincent created his belief system, animals were a big part of it. He literally believed and taught that animals are people too, meaning they have the same complex thoughts and feelings as humans, and so therefore are equals. In MOVE, they're all one family, calling each other brother and sister. That applied to the animals as well. When MOVE is giving their spiel publicly about their love for animals, they'll always share that if a dog is sitting on the couch, you cannot move them for yourself to sit down. That would be a violation. That would be disrespectful, because all life is equal.
All of us would take care of the animals. Sue always had the most animals, like cats and dogs and stuff, but in general, there were a lot of like dogs. And these were litters of animals who, like the children being bred in MOVE, were bred for generations. So they had some of the core dogs from, I guess, like after 85, like in the 90s areas, who they would breed together or allow to breed. and then they would have puppies, and then whatever like dog they rescued would have puppies with that puppy, and like it was generations of dogs. The way the dogs were cared for and raised was very much how we were cared for and raised as a pack, as a group of animals that like only the fittest survive. When animals would die, kittens or puppies, they'd just be like thrown in the life.
Thrown in the life means thrown in the backyard compost. And that doesn't sound too bad until you realize that the teachings say that all life is equal and all life must cycle. So if the dog gets thrown in the compost, then humans belong in the compost too. MOVE says if you follow and are obedient under MOVE law, that you will be strong. If you don't, you're weak and you should be cycled.
We were always told that everything was to go back to mama, to go back to nature. And when animals weren't civilized enough, or they weren't trained enough, or they weren't like just beaten down enough, we would, or they just simply didn't like the animal. There's times where it would never justify why my pets disappeared.
Rain says that if an animal is sickly or problematic, then it was taken to the forest, just gotten rid of. MOVE members born into the organization have said on this podcast that when they tried to resist leadership, they were threatened with being thrown out on the street, also disposed of.
Animals are people too. We were taught that being raised, you're no better than the bug on the ground or the bird in the sky or that puppy. They are your equal. Your life is as valuable as their life and vice versa. Only the fittest survive.
This MOVE logic was about dehumanizing its members so that neglect, abuse, and death was normalized. MOVE has always said they don't believe in categories, and that includes the whole animals are people too, which normalized some pretty abnormal behavior.
Back in the day in the like 80s and stuff, the babies would be born in hay and stuff. And then it evolved to like the dogs and stuff laying in hay in like a makeshift pen in the front of her like room. My experience was that the dog got sick and she had a litter of puppies, and we were to bottle feed the puppies because she wasn't able to. So they would get like goat's milk, the same milk that they would feed the babies, and we warm it up and we would bottle feed. We like goat's milk and like egg, and you whisk it up and it's supposed to help. And we would bottle feed the dog. Rhea like lifted up her shirt and started trying to nurse the dog from her breast. And she was laying in the hay and like sitting in the hay with us trying to breastfeed the puppies.
Yes, Rain just said Rhea was trying to breastfeed puppies.
And was saying like, it's natural, they need a mother.
I was super freaked out when I first heard this and I didn't want to think it was true, but it is. It happened 15 years ago. Rain was 8 and Rhea was 60. Rhea was not the only one to do this. There were MOVE members who were nursing babies who followed Rhea's lead. This bizarre story is true. I verified it with 3 different sources independently. This is Rhea in her role of second in command of the MOVE cult. But Rhea was also given the activity of running her own cult within the MOVE cult, made up of white people. In the Rhea cult, she's the boss. Not really, because Alberta was her boss, but this activity gives Rhea a sense of power and purpose, and she loves it. Rhea's love bombing to her white posse is packaged like she's the cool aunt slash mentor slash therapist slash expert on how to not be racist. If, as a white supporter, you were chosen to get this close to Rhea and MOVE, you were eager to please. Like Kevin Price, who first met MOVE members when he was just 14 and then became a recruiting target of Rhea, specifically so that she could convince him to move up to Philadelphia after graduating from high school.
I got a lot of praise, mainly coming from Rhea. I was like on top of the world from that. Like, it felt so good. And that was, I mean, there's such an addictive quality to that kind of praise.
Rhea would always have at least one female as her protege slash teacher's pet. After Tony and Lori Allen publicly defect from MOVE in 2004, Rhea has to find a new white female protege, and she picks Mega, who's dating Kevin.
I was Rhea's right-hand lady. She always has one.
Rhea would figure out activities for these white supporters. During Alberta's child custody battle with ex-MOVE member John Gilbride, who was white, white supporters were ordered to stalk, intimidate, and defame both John and his family. Rhea, of course, just called it protesting or demonstrating. Just like with Black MOVE members and children, Rhea would have meetings on white supporters to chastise them, gather intel, love bomb them, get closer to them, like making them share intimate details of their sex life with another white MOVE supporter. Rhea's son, born into MOVE, that died on May 13, 1985, was mixed race. The father of Alberta's son, Zachary, is the late John Gilbride, who was white. And while Alberta was indeed pregnant and gave birth via C-section at age 48, it is an open secret in MOVE that a Caucasian egg donor was used and that Zach is 100% white. And that was explained to other MOVE members by Alberta that she is white and that MOVE's founder, Vincent Leapheart, a.k.a. John Africa, a.k.a. her former mate, had prophesied that she would give birth to a white son who would become the next leader of MOVE and take it global, making it as big as Scientology or bigger. Part of this grand master, white supremacist sounding plan was that Zach would need a white female mate that is in the MOVE beliefs. And so recruiting white members was of course part of that. The first white couple in MOVE to have a child was Tony and Lori Allen. And Lori remembers when she first realized MOVE's plans.
They were telling me that, you know, Zach was going to be more of a figurehead when he got older. He was 5 years old when my daughter was born. And I had her dressed up in a little dress. Sue was talking to Zach, and she was just basically telling him that at some point she'll be a grown woman and explaining her in a way to a five-year-old to kind of indicate this could be your wife down the road. And just said, isn't she just such a pretty baby? Look at her. Isn't she so pretty? Why don't you go give her a kiss? It was the most awkward thing I had ever experienced. Kind of felt like I wasn't really included in the conversation. And so Zach walked over very slowly and he leaned over and awkwardly kissed her head. I was basically in the same situation as Zach. You know, whether I liked it or not, this is what the organization wanted.
Alberta and Rhea did not get what they wanted, Tony and Lori's daughter. Tony, Lori, and their daughter left MOVE very publicly almost 20 years ago. For the last 15 years or so, Rhea has not been out front as the face of MOVE because it doesn't fit the Black liberation narrative that MOVE has been selling to supporters, academics, and Hollywood. Speaking of Hollywood and movies, I have a Rhea story for you from former MOVE follower Mega.
Did you hear about when Rhea and I had lunch with John Waters?
John Waters, as in the movie director of Crybaby and Hairspray, considered cult classics.
So he is like a supporter. Yeah, he's donated to them for sure. And he was always interested in Rhea. So he was coming into town one time. This is years ago. He asked me to come. It was at that hotel. I don't remember what it's called right now, but if you're at City Hall, it's the Northeast Corner Hotel. And we went there because he was staying there and we had lunch and Rhea told me how to dress. Like she was like, wear a jeans jacket, like wear this, like whatever. And so she and I were like in our like hers and hers, like jeans and jeans jackets, you know, like we were wearing the uniform and we had our surreal lunch with John Waters, who's great. And I was super excited. She wasn't super clear in who he was, but she was trying to understand better why he was a supporter. And at one point he did say, he was like, it was your look. He was like, you guys would all go into court wearing like jeans jackets and jeans and like cuss out the judges and everybody, and he just liked the affect of it, like the look of it. I still get his Christmas cards. Thank you, John Waters.
John Waters fangirling Rhea would be shocking if it wasn't widely known that John Waters also communicated with the convicted murderers from the Charles Manson cult. Maybe John Waters just didn't really know who Rhea was. A lot of people didn't. Maybe he'll listen to the podcast. Mega and Kevin publicly broke with MOVE in 2021. But Kevin actually, quote unquote, woke up from the MOVE cult back in 2007.
It felt like I got hit by lightning, not physically, not like a physical shock, but like I could almost physically feel my brain rewiring itself. And I don't know exactly what I was thinking about. I know I was like mulling over some contradiction within move belief and behavior. And all of a sudden, it felt like my brain just broke and I couldn't hold back the mountains of conflicting ideas anymore. And I got myself together and turned onto a street. And I just remember sitting there and staring into space. And I had this thought like, oh my God, they murdered John. Like, it was not a question. It was like, what the hell? Like, I'm 24 years old at that point. Like, what the hell am I doing with my life? Like, what is going on? How did I get here? And it almost felt like the person that I was before I ever encountered MOVE had this intense collision with the person that I was at that point in time. And those two people didn't know one another. I felt like a different person to the degree that, like, when I got home, I worried that I wouldn't be able to walk the way that I used to walk. It almost felt like a psychedelic experience. Like, it felt like I had experienced a reality that I'd never experienced before, and I was forever changed by it, and I would never, ever, ever be able to see the world that way again. It felt like an inoculation against fully believing anything. And I was totally screwed in a way because I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to even remember how to be the person that I was like an hour before. And I didn't want to just pack up and leave because I was married to the woman that I'm still married to. And I had met her as an activist when I was already deep in MOVE. She was probably more of a true believer even than I had ever been. And I was a true believer, but she, for all of her own personal reasons and all of the things in her life that she was trying to reconcile, she was very susceptible to the grooming and to having Rhea make her feel like she was her long-lost daughter.
Kevin had to keep his big realization to himself as he tries to figure out how to convince Mega to leave with him. But his plan backfires when someone else spills the beans to Mega that Kevin no longer believes in MOVE. And Mega, as trained, calls Rhea immediately, who comes over, entering their house with her set of keys. And they hold a meeting on Kevin.
Rhea, Carlos, and Bert drove up and just came in. And that was really awful for him. Like, we were in the bedroom, that back bedroom, and they all came in. And he, I know, felt really cornered and trapped. I felt like the armory had showed up for me, like on my defense, because I trusted them. I thought they were there to help.
What did they say?
I don't know, they were here for a while. I remember we were back there and then we went into the living room. It was aggressive. It was for sure too much. Just talking to him a lot about, I mean, the normal shtick. Everyone has problems. Everyone comes to this at different times. Remember how you were before, blah. You don't know your brain, basically, is kind of what it amounts to.
This is a meeting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how did he respond?
He got quieter and more agreeable.
Both Alberta and Rhea are old pros about knowing whether they actually have control over somebody. And even though Kevin did submit, they're not sure. So Rhea invites Kevin to tea.
Rhea called me and she was very stern. I need you to come down to King's Testing and talk to me after work on whatever day. And I kind of knew what was coming. So I was just trying to figure out a way to get through it without completely tipping my hand. But I was also really emotional and mad. she brought out tea and cookies, and, you know, she played nice for a while, and we made small talk. Like, after a couple of minutes, her mood completely flipped, and she looked at me really intensely without breaking eye contact and said, "You think we killed John, don't you?" And I, for whatever reason, I couldn't lie. I was just so frustrated, and I responded quickly, and I said, "Yeah, I do." And she went into this long diatribe about how I only thought that because I was raised in a white racist society, and I was raised to hate black people and think that black people are violent, and that because Moose is predominantly black and Bert is black and John was white, of course I would see them as being violent towards him because John was white. So because of my training, I would see him as innocent and Bert as guilty, and just all of this crazy nonsense that's like completely twisting all of the ideas of racial justice that led me there in the first place, and like weaponizing empathy and weaponizing a desire for justice. And I did what I had to do to kind of act like I saw her point. And I pushed back a little bit, but then pulled back very quickly and just tried as fast as I could to bring the conversation to an end. And I left feeling completely just broken and not sure how to proceed, but I just kept plodding along. And weirdly enough, it gave me a freedom I hadn't had before, because I was out of the closet as not being a true believer anymore.
It takes 10 years before Mega herself sees that Rhea and Move are a dangerous controlling cult. Like Tony and Lori 15 years earlier, Kevin, Mega, and their young daughter leave Move and go public on this podcast in 2021. And like Tony, Kevin creates a blog sharing his journey in and out of Move as a cautionary tale. Suzanne Levino's journey from suburban white privilege into Move and then prison and then back to Move is bizarre and sad. And one wonders if mental illness might have been a factor that made her vulnerable to a cult. Even so, Sue, aka Rhea, hurt a lot of people. A lot of children born into Move like Rain were her victims.
She genuinely lives in my nightmares. Like, the days I wake up from bad dreams from the cult, she's in them. She's a monster. She's a pedophile. She's a racist. She's a homophobic pig. She is the epitome of evil. She's disgusting to even think someone like her was allowed around children and was allowed to partake in raising children. Like, I believe there's no cell deep enough in jail to hold her. She needs to be in the pits of hell for everything she's done.
Please be sure to follow the podcast and our social media accounts, all under Murder at Ryan's Run, for updates and bonus content. If you have any information about the unsolved murder of John Gilbride or anything else related to the podcast reporting, please reach out to us via email, murderatryansrun@gmail.com, or message us on our socials. We also love to get questions or comments from you. This episode was edited, hosted, and written by Beth McNamara. Archival research and additional producing by Robert Helms. Thanks for listening. The producers wish to stress that all individuals referenced in this podcast series are presumed innocent unless or until they are proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law in the United States of America.